a tumour that's actually the fourth largest cause of death from cancer. A statistic made even more deadly because it's actually not one of the commonest malignancies. Yet 95% of those who develop it have died within 5 years, and most of them after just 6 months. It's a tumour that doctors often give up on right from the start and which is under-treated in Australia. Only a fraction of people who could be operated on are actually offered surgery, much less referred to a surgical centre that has specific expertise. I'm talking about pancreatic cancer. The pancreas sits behind the bowel in the upper abdomen and does two or three things. It produces enzymes which are transported into the intestine to help digest food. It produces insulin to help us convert sugar to energy. And it allows the passage of bile from the liver to the intestine. As you're about to hear from a world authority on pancreatic cancer who's just been in Australia, it's a hidden, neglected cancer whose time may have come. Margaret Temporal is Deputy Director of the University of California, San Francisco's Comprehensive Cancer Center.
Its impact on cancer-related deaths is huge, as you say. The disease is often diagnosed late, so many patients are not candidates, say, for curative surgery. The impact, as you say, is correct, the fourth most common cause of death, because only 4 to 5% of the patients who are diagnosed with pancreatic cancer are going to reach 5 years.
What is it about this cancer that is so nasty?
I wish I could answer that with a lot of specificity, but I can tell you that there are certain things that we know. For one, the disease is diagnosed late. The pancreas is a fairly silent organ, and so you don't have any localizing signs and symptoms that really allow the patient or the physician to really focus in on the pancreas very early. And so many times we'll see patients who have been suffering with very nonspecific symptoms for quite a long period of time.
What's the typical story?
Queasiness or symptoms that might sound a little bit like dyspepsia or even heartburn. They might have vague back pain that comes and goes.
So it's almost as vague as the symptoms people talk about with ovarian cancer.
Exactly. In fact, one of our research ideas is that one could come up with a symptom complex that would make patients and physicians think about pancreatic cancer earlier, which would prompt a diagnostic workup to try and determine that. The other sign that occurs with this disease is that it actually causes diabetes. It's a little bit confusing because diabetes is also a risk factor for the disease. But we know that almost 80% of the patients have impaired glucose metabolism. In other words, some abnormality that may look like frank diabetes or something that's on its way to being diabetes.
And the GP thinks, well, this is just common or garden type 2 diabetes.
That's right. That's right. And so one of the ideas is perhaps we could use diabetes and early diabetes as an indicator that something might be wrong, but we'll have to understand what is special about diabetes related to pancreatic cancer versus other garden variety diabetic conditions.
But it's more than that, isn't it? I mean, because even when you've got the cancer, it seems to behave differently from other cancers of its kind.
Very much so. So in addition to the fact that it doesn't have any early signs and symptoms.
I'm sorry, we should just, to interrupt you here, the people who are lucky are those where you think these are the people who are worst off, but who present with jaundice, where it squeezes the bile duct from the liver. They're the lucky ones who get the early signs that you may actually
that
have a treatable
can
cancer.
Be. It just depends on the location of the cancer, because if it's close to the bile duct, which is a fairly small structure, it doesn't require much growth to compress the bile duct. But we know that the cancer, even when it's early like that, can have very early invasion and spread to other organs. So unlike other diseases, which when it's very small, say, you know, a centimeter in size, most tumors that size, regardless of what their organ they're arising in, very rarely give rise to spread in, say, lymph nodes or organ-based sites.
Because in fact, in cancer, they talk about T1 being a critical feature.
Right, right. And with this disease, even at 1 centimeter, already there has been often lymph node spread. So there's something about this disease that once it starts to invade, the invasion and metastatic process is very rapid. So we have that going against us. The third thing is that it's often thought to be rather treatment resistant. And I think we're getting some very exciting new signals that that may not exactly be the case. It may be that there is actually a barrier to diffusion of drug into the tumor. And I can talk a little bit about that if you're interested. Then the fourth reason that it's so difficult, the cancer disables its host.
Means you or me, if we've got
right,
it.
Right, right. And it does so by elaborating many hormones called cytokines that cause disabling symptoms, including sort of wasting away. people get a lot of muscle loss and loss of fat deposits.
So you don't live well with this cancer, whereas some other cancers you might do, like breast cancer, you can live for years, even though it's spread quite far.
The cancer is actually disabling its host, even though there may not be a huge cancer burden.
And there's some evidence, I understand, that surgeons treat this a bit too gingerly, that there are people who would benefit from surgery who are told perhaps too early, too soon, that they're not operable.
There is a lot of therapeutic nihilism that occurs in, at least in the US. I'm not so familiar with the patterns of practice in Australia, but we do know, based on some actually research that's been published, that there are many patients who are simply told, look, the odds are so much against you, we won't even work it up, just go home and, you know,
put your affairs in order.
Exactly.
Whereas they could be treated more aggressively.
That's what we believe. Probably half the patients who have resectable disease are not being referred to surgeons.
A half?
That is one estimate.
And from what I hear of Australia, it may be at least that, if not higher. And the surgery is fairly major. It's not a nice organ to operate on.
You know, it is major, but the mortality rates from surgery have dropped dramatically over the last 20 years. And so if you go to a center of excellence where there is a high volume of pancreatic surgeons and surgeries, you'll do fine. Your mortality rate is very low. Morbidity, though, is 100%. We're talking about an organ that's not critical for life, but very convenient. Postoperative complications that sometimes patients do have to live with. Diabetes, though, is rare because you don't take the whole pancreas if you can help it. You only take a portion of it and you spare some for that function.
So what do we know are the risk factors? Smoking is one.
The biggest risk factor, actually, is your family history. Like in all diseases, there is a certain percentage of these cancers that are tied to a hereditary predisposition. And we believe that if you actually understood that a little bit better, you could improve the or enrich the population that would need to be screened, because you actually can screen for this disease. It's been shown in high-risk families that are at risk because of their family history that you can screen using endoscopic ultrasound, which is a type of radiographic technique using an endoscope that's passed down into the stomach. And with that technique, you can delineate the ducts within the pancreas very well. And that's where you have to look. You want to find it before a CAT scan, for instance, could find it. So you want to find it when the ducts are just early on being
So it's affected. A pretty harmless technique to actually find it.
It is, but it's, you know, it's expensive to, you wouldn't be able to do that on the population at large because the cost benefit wouldn't be appropriate.
And you've got to have a radiologist who knows what they're doing.
You have to have a gastroenterologist. It's actually done by a gastroenterologist. And the training is very special for understanding how to do that procedure because it's very observer dependent. But the nice thing is that if you know who to look for the cancer in, you can diagnose it early. So we believe that there, in addition to genes that actually cause cancers that run in families, there are susceptibility genes that would allow us, if we knew what they were, would allow us to enrich the population for screening.
And are there other cancers in families that are running mates with pancreatic cancer when it runs in families?
Yes. So pancreas cancer is enriched in a number of well-defined syndromes. The BRCA1 and 2 mutations.
So the breast cancer genes.
Breast cancer genes are associated with an excess risk for pancreatic cancer. And often, because of the type of practice I do, I will often be the first one to identify a family with a BRCA mutation. Because I'm seeing the patient, it's a younger patient, I start querying about the family and find out that some of the other cancers are tracking it within that family. That's one. There's also hereditary non-polyposis colorectal cancer.
So there's excess called Lynch syndrome, which goes along with uterine cancer and ovarian cancer.
Exactly. And then there is the familial atypical mole and melanoma syndrome. These are patients who have dysplastic moles and are prone to melanoma, but there is an increased risk of pancreatic cancer in those families. Peutz-Jeghers is another syndrome in which
you get
pancreatic
little black
cancer,
spots, particularly on your lips.
Right. Hereditary pancreatitis is another inherited syndrome in which there's a nearly 90% chance of getting pancreatic cancer over a lifetime.
And what about common or garden pancreatitis that people get, say, due to alcohol or just they don't know what the cause is?
The risk of pancreatic adenocarcinoma in chronic pancreatitis is real but small. It's only about a twofold increase in risk. Same as with cigarette smoking, a slight increase in risk. So whereas cigarette smoking maybe has an 8 or 10-fold increase in risk for lung cancer, maybe only 2-fold for this cancer.
So there's surgery and there's chemo. And chemo, when you look at the literature, to my mind, looks pretty hopeless. It doesn't really extend survival by very much at all.
It's been a very difficult nut to crack, if you pardon my way of speaking, but, you know, it's...
We speak much worse than that in Australia. Very mild.
We've tried a lot of different drug combinations, and many times they're very promising within a single institutional trial, but then when you get it out into community medicine, we don't seem to be able to reproduce the results. But the other important finding, this very neat publication that just came out in Science, showed in an animal model for pancreatic cancer that drugs just simply don't get in to the tumor. And this is because this tumor has a collaborative relationship with its microenvironment. And it creates a tissue called desmoplasia. It's sort of
the
stroma. So
it puts up a barrier.
And it actually becomes like a barrier. It also has a network of communication signals that occur between the cancer cells and its microenvironment. So the microenvironment, yes. So the microenvironment becomes a partner and a collaborator in aiding and abetting the invasion and metastasis or spread of the cancer.
And stopping anything that's going to kill it.
Yeah.
In the end.
So what this paper has told us is that, number one, we have to pay attention to treating the stroma.
Which is
the supporting tissue. And by doing so, we will, number one, hopefully disable the tumor to some degree. Number two, allow drugs to get into the tumor. And what this paper showed was that the same drug that could effectively treat a transplanted tumor couldn't treat the tumor sited in the pancreas.
So in other words, you had a tumor which you could treat in another place, but as soon as you put it into the pancreas, it went mad.
You could use the drug to treat the tumor at, say, a implantation site under the skin in the mouse.
But
you couldn't treat the tumor that was naturally sited in the pancreas. But once you treated the surrounding tissue around the pancreas, then the same drug that previously couldn't treat the tumor now becomes effective.
So what treats the supporting tissue?
Now, this is going to sound very strange, but there is a signaling pathway called Hedgehog. It's a very important pathway because it's involved in the formation of the pancreas, the development of the organ. And depending on whether it's activated or not, it helps the developing organ understand what parts of the pancreas need to make digestive enzymes and what parts need to make hormones, say, for glucose metabolism.
So it's a message pathway.
Well, it turns out that that same pathway is the pathway that cancer cells are using to talk to the environment in the pancreas. And now that we understand that and we can develop inhibitors to that pathway, we can interrupt it.
And is there anything around? Any candidates around?
Well, in this particular study, they did use a candidate that I assume will be used as either a new drug or at least a prototype for a new drug.
The other issue here is that although it's a common killer, it's not a common cancer, so it's presumably hard to recruit enough people into pancreatic cancer trials.
We haven't found that to be a problem. Patients are motivated. They understand that it's a difficult disease. People, I think, get the point that participating in a clinical trial may be the best care that they can receive. And so in our experience, it's actually been quite easy to recruit patients for clinical trials. And both the patients and the referring physicians are very eager to see progress made.
So you said you were meeting at the National Institutes of Health. How well funded is pancreatic cancer compared to the other tumors, given that it's the fourth biggest killer?
Well, you'd think that given these statistics, it would be a major target for federal funding. And as it turns out, it's actually hasn't been. If you look at the funding that is leveraged toward prostate and breast cancer, pancreatic cancer probably only gets about a tenth per case fatality. So there clearly is a huge need for more funding. And arguably, if the funding was there, the progress would be made. All of the progress that we've made in breast cancer, prostate cancer, happened because funding was made available to smart people who knew how to address the difficult issues in those diseases. And we've now made prostate and breast cancer a disease that's almost a chronic disease. If you don't cure it, the next best thing would be to make it a chronic disease that people can live naturally with and have a normal lifespan. And we're getting closer and closer to that.
Dr. Margaret Tempero is Director of Clinical Sciences at the University of California, San Francisco's Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center.